Usually when you open a commercial real estate dossier, you prepare yourself for, well, a sterile mathematical document.
Right, something very clinical.
Exactly. You expect to see capitalization rates, price per square foot, zoning ordinances.
Traffic flow analyses.
Yeah. It's supposed to be clean, objective, just a financial abstraction of concrete and steel.
But the reality of urban spaces, I mean, it completely defies that kind of sterile categorization.
It really does.
We prefer to view the physical landscape through this lens of pure utility, right? Kind of ignoring the fact that urban infrastructure actually absorbs and dictates human behavior.
And sometimes it dictates something much darker.
Absolutely.
Welcome to this deep dive into what we are calling the Midnight Ledger. We are slowing down our usual cadence today, lowering the lights a bit.
Setting the mood.
Yeah, because we have been granted access to a private, highly confidential investigative dossier. Specifically, we are opening case log Kim 1991-069-FIC.
And it is vital to establish our parameters right at the top here. You and I are strictly observers in this investigation.
Right. We are just reading the file.
Exactly. The architect of this dossier, Priyanshu Atathakar, who goes professionally as Pri Prate, he is the lead investigative reporter here.
He's the singular authoritative voice on the ground.
Yes, we are merely analyzing his fieldwork.
And Pri operates with this really fascinating dual perspective that, frankly, most investigators simply do not have.
This is totally unique.
He is an investment advisor and a peer to other realtors. He specializes in the kind of complex commercial real estate puzzles that permanently stall major development deals.
Distressed properties, boutique hotel zoning riddles.
Abandoned industrial lots.
Where a standard developer just sees a bad investment, Pri sees a hidden history that is actively suppressing the property's value.
Right, because when millions of dollars are on the line and a commercial lot refuses to yield to standard development logic, well, Pri's the one who gets called in.
He understands that a property's future potential is inextricably linked to whatever trauma or history it might be actively hiding in its past.
He looks at the anatomy of the lot itself. Think of Pri's work like a forensic audit. But, instead of tracking hidden shell companies or offshore accounts.
He's auditing the structural soul of a building.
Exactly. Which brings us to the lead case in today's ledger. Pri uses the unsolved 1991 disappearance of a woman named Suya Kim to demonstrate this.
He shows how human tragedy intimately intersects with the abandoned, forgotten corners of our urban real estate map.
So, to understand the spatial anomaly Pri is investigating, we really have to look at the baseline of the Kim's life first.
Right. In this report, Pri uncovers a classic, thriving integration into the American commercial landscape.
Yeah. In 1981, Suya and her husband, Soo Young Kim, emigrate from Seoul, South Korea.
And over the next decade, they build up this highly successful grocery business in Brooklyn.
They eventually move into a really spacious, comfortable apartment in Queens with their two young sons.
They are the anchors of a thriving community. I mean, they understand commercial foot traffic, they understand neighborhood integration.
They are actively contributing to the lifeblood of the city.
Yeah.
But that upward trajectory violently halts on the evening of June 29th, 1991.
It's just tragic.
Suya, who is 31 years old at the time, leaves her boys with their grandmother at the Queens apartment.
Just for a routine late-night grocery run.
Right. And she never returns.
Now, the first geographic dissonance in Pri's report occurs almost immediately after this.
Yeah, her vehicle is discovered in the parking lot of a Brooklyn shopping mall.
But the physical state of the vehicle completely contradicts the reality of a sudden, forced abduction.
The car is entirely undisturbed. The windows are intact, the doors are locked.
There are absolutely no signs of a struggle.
And I have to push back on the prevailing theories here, because Pri's report categorizes this window of time as the ghost hours.
Right, that period between a disappearance and early morning when the city empties out.
But a commercial shopping mall lot, even late at night, has ambient lighting, it has security patrols.
Residual pedestrian presence,
Yeah.
yeah.
So how does someone just evaporate from a designed retail environment without a single scream or a trace?
It's baffling.
It totally defies the basic mechanics of how commercial spaces are engineered.
Well, that is precisely why Prize zeroes in on the geography. You are thinking of a retail space as a continuous zone of observation.
Right, like someone is always watching.
But Prize architectural analysis points out that modern commercial lots are actually designed to create systemic blind spots during those ghost hours.
Oh, interesting.
Once the retail anchors close, the flow of foot traffic ceases entirely. The lighting grid often leaves deep shadows at the perimeter.
So the space transitions from a high-density communal hub into a literal void.
Exactly. And the transition from where she went missing to where she was ultimately found, well, that is the spatial puzzle Pry is trying to solve.
Let's follow Pry's lens to the discovery then, because the geography shifts dramatically here.
It really does.
The dossier fast forwards 10 hours to June 30th, exactly at 3:00 a.m.
We are no longer in a well-lit Queens neighborhood or a Brooklyn retail center.
No. We are 7 miles away in Bedford-Stuyvesant at an abandoned, derelict commercial building.
It's a completely dead zone on the urban grid.
Yeah, and a private security guard named Joe Jones is contracted to patrol this distressed property.
The report notes that his established patrol route is highly regimented, very predictable.
Yet on this specific night, he deviates from that standard perimeter walk.
He walks into a highly secluded alleyway and approaches a massive commercial trash receptacle.
Dumpster number 4.
Right. And here is where the human element collides with the structural environment.
Jones spots an unidentified man standing near this isolated dumpster.
And when Jones approaches, the man instantly flees.
He jumps into a blue Nissan, speeds away, but then he brakes at the corner of the block just to watch the guard's reaction.
Pry points out that this is a calculated behavioral risk.
How so?
The perpetrator knows the guard's presence disrupts the isolation of the space, but he needs visual confirmation of whether his hidden cache has been compromised.
Ah, I see.
But that hesitation at the corner guarantees Jones is going to investigate the dumpster.
Exactly. So Jones and a companion who had joined him on the patrol, they begin clearing the debris.
And amidst the industrial refuse and urban decay, they uncover a human hand.
It is Soo-Yah Kim.
The forensic reality documented in the NYPD files only deepens the procedural mystery here.
Yeah, the medical examiner confirmed Soo-Yah had been stabbed 9 times.
She was discovered entirely nude, yet biological testing revealed 0 evidence of sexual assault.
And taking sexual assault off the table drastically alters the perpetrator profile.
It really forces investigators to look at robbery or just sheer opportunistic violence.
Considering her purse and jewelry were missing, yeah.
But every single conventional lead the NYPD pursued turned into a staggering dead end.
Consider the blue Nissan. I mean, Jones was a highly observant witness.
Right. He gave detectives a really detailed physical description of the car and a partial license plate.
And the police actually located a vehicle matching those exact specifications. They tracked it to a Taiwanese exchange student attending college out on Long Island.
But the logistical reality of the city map cleared her completely.
Yeah, the student had an absolutely airtight alibi.
When detectives inspected the Nissan in the middle of the night, the engine block was stone cold.
You cannot drive from Bedford-Stuyvesant to a Long Island campus, park the car,
and have a cold engine by the time police arrive.
Right. Plus, forensics found absolutely nothing inside the cabin.
So with the primary physical lead neutralized, investigators naturally applied pressure to the structural anomaly of the case.
To guard himself.
Exactly. Why was Joe Jones at that specific dumpster at that exact time?
They interrogated him extensively, but Jones willingly submitted to a polygraph examination.
And he passed without a single deceptive marker.
The NYPD eventually cast a wider net, comparing the crime scene to the active radius of notorious serial killers operating in the region during that era.
Joel Rifkin, Tommy Lynn Sells, Rex Horman.
But the behavioral and physical signatures didn't line with any of them. They just hit a complete brick wall.
The traditional investigative framework failed because it was exclusively looking for human error.
Okay, I need to interrupt here because this is where my reading of Pry's dossier hits a major friction point.
Okay, lay it out.
The NYPD hit a wall, yes. But Pry's report pivots away from the fleeing suspect in the Nissan and heavily emphasizes what he calls the sentinel's intuition.
Yes, phase 2 of his analysis.
Jones told detectives he felt an unseen force, like an irresistible, illogical urge to deviate from his patrol and check that exact dumpster.
Right.
I have to be honest, this sounds dangerously close to a ghost story.
I get why you'd say that.
We are analyzing commercial real estate and urban development. Why is an investment advisor entertaining the idea of a mystical pull?
Because you are misinterpreting his use of the word pull. Pry isn't diagnosing a paranormal event here.
He isn't.
No, he is diagnosing profound environmental psychology. The sentinel's intuition is deeply rooted in spatial awareness.
Okay.
You have to look at the building as a closed ecosystem.
An ecosystem? I mean, it's an abandoned brick shell.
Exactly. And a security guard patrolling that shell night after night maps its baseline decay subconsciously.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Jones knows the exact ambient noise of the wind through broken glass. He knows the specific shadows cast by the streetlights.
But Prey argues that Jones didn't feel a ghost.
Right. His brain subconsciously registered a disruption in the physical environment.
Like a misplaced piece of debris.
Or an altered shadow profile near dumpster number 4. Or even the residual scent of copper or panic.
Wow. When an environment is totally stagnant, any anomaly screams at the human subconscious.
Precisely. So the pull wasn't supernatural, it was an acute architectural awareness.
The building's disrupted state alerted the guard.
Yes. Prey writes, and I quote, "The guard was investigated. He passed every test. The question isn't how he knew, the question is why the building let him know."
That reframes the entire crime scene.
It does.
We are so conditioned to look for a smoking gun in the hands of a suspect, but Prey is forcing us to view the distressed environment itself as the primary witness.
And that is the defining methodology of his work. You cannot divorce a commercial property from the context of its surrounding grid.
Right.
The geography of Bedford-Stuyvesant in 1991 is vital to understanding the perpetrator.
The dossier highlights that dumpster number 4 was completely invisible from the main thoroughfare.
You could not see it from a passing patrol car.
So the NYPD theorized the killer possessed extensive, highly localized geographic knowledge.
A cab driver, a nighttime delivery worker, maybe a municipal employee.
Someone who understood the dead zones of the borough.
They needed someone who knew where the municipal lighting failed, where the foot traffic dropped to zero.
And where the sight lines were obstructed by industrial architecture.
They needed someone who knew the voids.
Yet despite that incredibly specific profile, the investigation stalled permanently in 1992.
It's tragic.
And the human cost of that failure is difficult to quantify. By April of 1993, Soo Young Kim realized the city was never going to offer him justice.
So he made a drastic choice.
He closed down a thriving, profitable Brooklyn business, packed up his 2 sons, and abandoned the country entirely, returning to South Korea.
The economic and emotional anchor of that family was just erased.
It leaves behind an open file in the cold case archives. But it also leaves behind the physical soil where the trauma occurred.
The structural environment remains.
And this is where Prey applies his fellow realtor lens to decode why certain properties remain permanently distressed.
In real estate valuation, we constantly hear the cliche location, location, location regarding market capitalization.
Sure.
But Prey is taking that exact financial principle and applying it to victimology and perpetrator profiling.
He is essentially arguing that these abandoned commercial properties are not passive backdrops.
Right. They are active structural accomplices to urban mysteries.
He is stating it as a matter of professional fact. A homicide detective looks at an abandoned lot and sees a frustrating lack of potential witnesses.
But Prey looks at that same lot and sees a complex, engineered environment of concealment.
He recognizes that navigating and exploiting these hidden commercial lots requires a specialized understanding of zoning neglect.
And deferred maintenance.
But, I mean, are we really blaming the architecture? A concrete wall doesn't force someone to commit a crime. It just sits there.
It doesn't force the act, no, but it facilitates the opportunity. Think about municipal zoning.
Okay.
When a city allows a commercial sector to decay, when streetlights go unreplaced, when broken fences aren't fined by code enforcement.
The city is inadvertently engineering a safe harbor for illicit activity.
Exactly. Prey solves the puzzles that stall major commercial deals because he understands the history of a lot dictates its current utility.
An empty building isn't a blank spreadsheet waiting for a developer's capital.
No. As Prey writes in the ledger, abandoned spaces are containers for the things we want to forget.
A container for the things we want to forget. That phrasing is heavy.
It really is.
It suggests that the city's infrastructure physically absorbs the trauma of its inhabitants.
And it implies that until you address the history of that container, you can never truly rehabilitate the property.
You cannot just pour new concrete over old violence and expect the market to respond favorably.
The killer utilized the urban decay. The isolation of dumpster number 4 wasn't a coincidence.
It was a structural feature of the property that the perpetrator deliberately exploited.
And Prey sees this dynamic in every distressed property he audits.
Which brings us to the final verdict of this specific case log.
The bottom line for the Soo Young Kim tragedy is unfortunately static. The case remains completely unsolved.
It is a devastating intersection of municipal decay and human cruelty.
The traditional justice system exhausted its methodology and just walked away.
But for the listeners out there who operate in the investment space or who simply navigate the urban environment every day, Pri offers a definitive, actionable framework.
Yes. If you study his broader portfolio, from consulting on elite boutique hotels to unraveling complex zoning riddles, his overarching thesis is clear.
When the buildings start to speak.
That is the crucial takeaway for any commercial investor.
Even when a property is completely vacant, stripped down to the studs, or boarded up for decades.
It is never operating in silence.
The energy, the behavioral patterns, and the historical weight left behind in those shadowed corners fundamentally matter.
The history of the land is an inseparable component of the asset.
Think about your own daily commute. Think about the vacant industrial lots, the chronically failing retail spaces.
Or the perpetually distressed commercial properties you drive past in your own city.
We tend to view them just as eyesores or bad investments. But what architectural histories are buried under that pavement?
What is the unseen ledger of that specific plot of land?
If we connect Pri's fieldwork to the broader macroeconomic picture of how we value, buy, and sell property, it forces a highly provocative question.
It really does. If commercial properties genuinely retain the historical weight and the structural energy of the tragedies that occurred on their grounds,
should that dark history be a legally mandated disclosure on a real estate ledger during a transfer of ownership?
That would completely upend commercial valuation.
In residential real estate, some states require you to disclose if a house is stigmatized by a violent crime.
But in commercial real estate, you're buying the dirt and the potential.
Right. If an investor has to legally disclose a property's ghost hours, how do you even begin to calculate that risk?
How does the ghost of a property impact its capitalization rate?
Can an underwriter truly price in the financial risk of a sentinel's intuition?
If a building served as a container for something the city desperately wanted to forget, the new buyer surely has a right to know exactly what kind of structural trauma they are inheriting.
It changes the entire paradigm of how you look at a simple for sale sign on a chain link fence.
It really changes everything.
The next time you find yourself walking past an abandoned space in the quiet hours of the night, look closely at the sight lines.
Look at the shadows.
The windows might be bricked over, the developers might have walked away, but the architecture might just have a history that is waiting to broadcast.
We'll leave you to audit the shadows of your own city's ledger.
Until the next case file.